désastre et pas un ami. La place est déserte et perdue.
As the Paris Commune wore on, and it became clear to everyone involved that Paris would be defeated, participants refused to lose hope. Two episodes ago, we saw Paris attempt to invade Versailles and fail spectacularly, as suburbs all around Paris were captured by Versailles' forces. What happened next? As the war continued and Paris lost ground and men, were introduced to a fascinating question. How do people act? How do governments rule? How do soldiers fight when they know that they're on the verge of annihilation? You're listening to Unraveled.
Je fus bon ouvrier tailleur, vieux que suis-je, une loque immonde.
The song in the background is called Jean Misère, or Jean Misery. The song mourned the lives of the working class, saying that a life full of sadness is the only option for the poor. No matter how people try to improve their lives, misery is never going to end. This episode, the fifth episode of Unraveled, is titled The Civil War, Part 2. A quick note, this podcast is semi-chronological, so it might make sense to go back and listen to previous episodes, which you can find at iTunes, any podcast app, or unraveledpodcast.com. In addition, in the gallery section at our website, you can find photos of all the characters mentioned during the episodes, something that may help as you listen. A few episodes ago, we looked at the beginning of the war between Paris and France. When we left off, Paris's attempt to sortie out and invade Versailles was bloodily repulsed, and the Commune appointed Gustave Clouseret as their war delegate. You're listening to Unraveled. After Paris revolted, a bunch of other large cities in France, such as Lyon, Marseille, Toulouse, also rebelled and tried to establish similar governments. These fizzled out quite quickly. Abroad, Karl Marx was tepid about the revolution and refused to offer it support. Other revolutionaries in England, Germany, and Italy all declined to back the Commune. Even the great Italian unifier, Giuseppe Garibaldi, who was elected to the Commune though never served, lived in Paris for some time, and even fought for France against Prussia, refused to publicly support the Commune. Left-wing members of the National Assembly in France, such as Victor Hugo, supported the National Assembly in its war against Paris. The city truly was alone. And once again, after the failed Parisian invasion in the beginning of April, the city was besieged. Clouseret set about trying to reform the National Guard within Paris, which was beyond disorganized. He tried to clear up the chain of command, establishing specific commanders for specific units, which seems logical but hadn't been done before. Meanwhile, from heights outside the city, French artillery rained shells upon Parisian forces in Neuilly, a suburb between Paris and Versailles. While inhabitants hid in cellars, a French invasion seized half of the suburb before their progress was halted due to a lack of forces. During the attack, a shell exploded among a number of students at a girls' school, an ominous prelude to what would soon happen to the innocent citizens of Paris. General Bergeret, who was routed during the sortie of April 3rd, defended Neuilly as the commandant of Paris, and was thrown into prison after its capture. He was replaced with the Polish general, Dombrowski. Now, Dombrowski stands out as one of the, maybe, only able commanders of the Communard forces. Upon his appointment, he immediately recaptured territory, from which he was able to shell French forces in Neuilly. The Commune, however, was unable to press any advantage. Historian Prosper Lissagoret described just how disorganized Paris was. Quote, Paris was ignorant of this success, so defective was the service of the general staff. This brilliant attack was the deed of one man, just as the defense of the forts was the spontaneous work of the National Guard. There was as yet no direction. Whoever cared to rush into some venture did so. Whoever wanted cannon or reinforcements went to ask for them at the Central Committee, at the Hotel de Ville, or of General Cluseret. End quote. Versailles soldiers frequently captured strategic points because Parisian defenders would fight unrelieved for days on end, despite countless reinforcements sitting in Paris with nothing to do. That Paris had so many potential leaders, each vying for command, meant that the Commune really had no leader. Generals didn't know who to ask for reinforcements, and very few were ever supplied. The war was increasingly horrific, especially in the suburbs, which saw most of the fighting, such as Neuilly. Neuilly resembled Leningrad from the Second World War. It was completely destroyed. This comes from historian Alistair Horn, who quoted a Communard officer, Colonel Stanley. Quote, "Every single tree is cut in pieces, and the ground is covered with grape, canister, shot, broken shells, and flattened bullets. I entered what had been beautiful houses, with floors wobbling, and held up only by a side, utterly wrecked. Billiard tables, looking glasses, sofas, and costly furniture all smashed to pieces. Guns placed in lovely gardens. The walls broken through to enable them to pass from one garden to another. We found the dead laid out, where they had been placed some days ago. And the people had lived as they could, in the cellars all this time on bread, and nothing else." End quote. Things were no better for the wounded than the dead. As Stanley estimated that of operations on 45 wounded soldiers, only one would survive. Most would die from gangrene or other infections, as the medical corps lacked almost all basic supplies. Stanley was most appalled not by the wounds, but by the incredible physical ailments that many soldiers suffered, a result of lives spent on the verge of starvation, combined with the siege only months ago. Quote, "What pains me most is not the wounds, but to see their poor shriveled legs, really not larger than a strong man's thumb." End quote. Despite the suffering of the Communard soldiers, the incompetence of Communard military structures, the ongoing siege, the bombardments, and the ever-present killing, Communard soldiers remained steadfast. One day, during a lull in fighting, Louise Michel was found playing organ in a deserted church. Gradually, though, as the National Assembly amassed more money, more resources, and more soldiers, released from Prussian prisoner of war camps, the constant bombardment raining down on Neuilly spread to the other suburbs of Paris. From the fortress at Mont-Valérien, French naval guns could reach into the center of the city. In major streets near the Hotel de Ville, were evacuated for entire days as shells fell, damaging world-famous monuments like the Arc de Triomphe. American and British embassies encouraged their citizens to flee the city any way they could. During Emperor Napoleon III's reign, Thiers had designed much of Paris under the grand city architect, Baron Haussmann, and Thiers knew that the best point to enter Paris would be in the southwest. However, before the National Assembly could begin any invasion, the gigantic fortress of Issy would have to be taken, as it protected the weak point where Thiers planned to enter. On April 25th, the French assault of Issy began in earnest. The National Assembly and the Commune worked out a ceasefire in Neuilly, and Communard soldiers focused on evacuating the civilians and soldiers who were close to death from wounds or starvation. The National Assembly, however, took the time to relocate its guns and soldiers to Issy, 10 kilometers to the south. Then began 5 days of ceaseless bombardment, and the fortress was nearly destroyed. Historian Prosper Lissagoret described its state after the bombardment. Quote, "It was no longer a fort, hardly even a fortified position, just a litter of shell-lashed earth and rubble." End quote. A worker named Meji was the commander of Issy, and no matter how many times he sent for reinforcements, Cluseret never sent him a soldier. The Communard defenders were forced to retreat on the 30th. spiking the guns of the fort before they evacuated to Paris. When the members of the commune discovered that Issy had fallen, they were furious. In a last-ditch effort to save his position as war delegate of the commune, Clouseret marched back to Issy at the head of just 200 men. Historian Alastair Horne described the surprising situation Clouseret found. Quote, "It was still as Mégy had left it, unoccupied, with the exception of an urchin of 16 or 17, weeping quietly upon a barrel of gunpowder placed on a wheelbarrow under the entrance. He had a match with which to ignite the barrel and was thus intending to blow up the fort and himself when the enemy entered." End quote. In a scene of complete buffoonery on all sides, the French commander had no idea the fort had been evacuated. And Clouseret simply walked back in, retook the fort, unspiked the guns, it hadn't been done properly in the first place, and prepared to defend Issy once again. But when Clouseret returned to the Hotel de Ville to announce his miraculous defense of Issy, he was arrested for his incompetence in letting it fall in the first place. The commune was abuzz that Clouseret had been arrested for plotting with Versailles. The rumor of his betrayal was probably due to his refusal to reinforce important positions. Really, Clouseret was just incompetent. To replace the imprisoned Clouseret, the commune appointed his former chief of staff, Louis Rossel, as the new delegate of war. Rossel was another of the commune's only capable military leaders. He had been a captain in the French army fighting against Prussia, and he was captured at Metz. He escaped from the prisoner of war camp and, disguised as a peasant, rejoined the French forces. When he found out about France's surrender to Prussia, he resigned his commission in the disgraced French army and joined the Parisian National Guard, the only faction in France that rejected the peace with Prussia. In charge of Paris, and just like Clouseret before him, Roussel tried to organize the National Guard. He sent General Eudes to defend Issy, and he actually tried to use the artillery scattered about Paris that had, to that point, been mostly ignored. Roussel discovered a curious problem as soon as he set out trying to organize the defense. Most National Guardsmen generally refused to fight unless it meant protecting their own homes. Few even left their arrondissement, their neighborhoods, and tens of thousands were absentees, leaving only 30,000 armed and willing combatants, compared to over 100,000 now fighting for Thiers in the National Assembly. Even Roussel's modest attempts at reorganization failed. The Central Committee continued trying to seize control of the National Guard from the Commune. On top of all of the different groups and people trying to command the National Guard, one more entered the fray. After Issy almost fell and Clouseret was arrested, the members of the Commune panicked and tried to elect a dictatorship named the Committee of Public Safety. However, much like every other political body in the Commune, the Committee of Public Safety was chaotic and it didn't really do much. At most, it just added another ineffective voice to the now deafening incompetence trying to govern Paris. As the governments in Paris squabbled, disagreed, and fought over who would control what, the French army slowly grew and grew. Towards the end of April, most people in Paris knew it was inevitable that Versailles would eventually break into the city. Throughout the war, even facing the almost certain massacre that would occur when Versailles entered Paris, the Commune continued trying to improve the lives of its citizens through its disjointed work inside the city. The Commune voted for lifetime pensions for the widows of workers killed while defending Paris. Government officials voted a wage cap on their own salaries at 6,000 francs a year, or roughly equivalent to what a worker made in a year. As far as I know, this has never happened in history before or since. Government members deciding to limit their own wages to equal those of their supporters. In addition, workshops abandoned by their owners were given to the collective ownership of the workers that continued to produce goods. The Commune acknowledged common law marriages, decreeing that the partners of soldiers killed in action would receive pensions whether they had been married or not. However, Despite the Commune's good intentions, few of these laws were put into action, not only because of the disorganization of the politics of the city, but also because the government's time was running out. By the beginning of May, the towns surrounding the fort at Issy were captured, and a spirited counterattack led by the Red Virgin, Louise Michel, was unable to recapture them for long. Throughout all of this, Issy continued to take a pounding. On May 7th, one of the fort officers described the rate of fire on Issy as being up to 10 shells a minute. As a point of comparison, according to historian Alastair Horn, this level of bombardment was similar to the amount of shells fired per minute by militaries in 1916 during the First World War. France wasn't pulling any punches when fighting its capital city. Delegate of War Roussel and Commandant of Paris Dombrowski together tried to hold Issy against its stupendous attack, but most National Guard commanders refused direct orders to reinforce the fort. Roussel was so frustrated by the lack of discipline in the Parisian military that he resigned on May the 8th as Delegate of War of the Commune. As the Commune debated, Issy finally fell for good, faced by more than 80 naval guns bombarding it. Roussel joined his predecessor, Cluseret, as holding the strange distinction of both being delegates of war of the Commune, followed by both being prisoners of the Commune's jails. The Commune reeled from the news of its failures, and it appointed one of its own members as the new delegate of war, the elderly but spirited member of the Commune, and one of its most charismatic leaders, Louis-Charles Delescluze. Delescluze's status in France as a revolutionary was surpassed only by Blanqui himself. He was the son of a 1792 revolutionary, and he had spent many long years inside of French prisons. He was one of the heroes of the Commune, its most talented speaker, but he achieved power too late to change the outcome that was already sealed. After Issy fell, the only other great fort held by the Commune, Vanves, fell on May 13th. Noy, however, remained sealed in combat, as Dombrowski refused to quit and retreat to Paris, despite receiving no reinforcements. Within the city, Communards turned towards spite, unable to defeat France in outright combat. Symbols of their opponents were destroyed, such as the Vendôme Column, representing the glory of the Napoleonic Wars. Adolphe Thiers' own house was vandalized and burned to the foundations. Finally, the Commune also began executing French prisoners and hostages. This spite couldn't last for long, as on the 21st of May, French soldiers began pouring into Paris. The days of the Commune had come to an end, and the Bloody Week had begun. Our next episode will describe the massacres. You're listening to Unraveled. Ça ne finira donc jamais, ça ne finira donc jamais. Je fus bon ouvrier tailleur. Vieux, que suis-je, une loque immonde. C'est l'histoire du travailleur depuis que notre monde est monde. Ah, mais ça ne finira donc jamais, ça ne finira donc jamais.